Hey everybody, Eric back with you. Today's podcast is going to be a podcast I'm real excited about. I was just speaking at the Metro Atlanta EMS Conference, ran into a good buddy of mine, Wes Foote, who flies for AirLife Georgia, and he told me about a trauma surgeon that was speaking at the conference, Dr. Morris. He's a trauma surgeon that works for Grady Memorial there in Atlanta, and his big passion is REBOA. Remember REBOA? We did a podcast on REBOA with Dr. Zafir Kazem. Probably 3 years ago. A lot has changed. More and more places are doing REBOA. So I thought, why not sit down and have a good conversation, kind of a questions and answers with Dr. Morris. And so I just wanted to set the tone. This is at a conference. There is some background noise, but I'm confident you're going to enjoy this. This is, you know, real life application, how it's being utilized, kind of what we're going to see in the future. So let's get started.
The content of this podcast is based on medical fact and evidence-based practice from credible authoritative sources, but is not a substitute for your institution's policies, procedures, common sense, or good judgment. The views and opinions are those of Eric Bauer and FlightBridge Ed in their entirety. This is the FlightBridge Ed Podcast, critical care and emergency medicine education for nurses and paramedics. Here's your host, Eric Bauer.
Hey everybody, welcome back. We're going to do a podcast today. I'm actually sitting here at the Metro Atlanta EMS Conference and joined by a physician at a Grady Memorial, Dr. Morris. Welcome.
Hey, thanks Eric. I appreciate your opportunity to be here.
Well, we're really happy to be able to talk about this topic. This is a topic that's really mainstream. A lot of people don't really know a lot about it, and I think there's a lot of questions we have in the pre-hospital arena. So the topic is going to be REBOA. So can you kind of go through your training, how you got to where you're at in your career and what you do?
So my background is actually, interestingly, in engineering. And the reason I picked engineering as an undergraduate major was to be innovative, and because I like working with my hands and gadgets and that sort of thing. One of the things I found was that that's not the world of an engineer, especially civil engineering. What actually got me into out of engineering into medicine was I met some pediatric surgeons who were very innovative with technology. And when I saw what they were doing, I was like, that's what I want to be. And those are the type of things that I want to do. And so that's what, after I met those guys, I went back and took the core classes for medical school, went on to medical school, did general surgery residency, and then I completed my training at Grady Memorial Hospital with really two icons of American surgery, Dr. David Feliciano and Grace Rizicki, who in their own rights were innovators with technology in trauma. And then after that, I went on to, went on into practice at Grady Memorial Hospital. So I've been with, I'm employed by Emory University. Okay. As a surgeon, but I spend 100% of my time at Grady doing trauma and trauma surgery and critical care.
It's really great that you did your undergraduate degree in engineering and then completely took a 90-degree turn, which I guess there's some relation there. It's the critical thinking side, using your hands, I love that. So the topic we're going to talk about today is REBOA. So, we did a podcast about 3 years ago with a physician that I think we mutually know, Zafir Kazem out of, he was in Delaware at the time, and I think REBOA was very, very new to the to the United States. We saw an initial case done by London Hems, where they did that on scene, and I think that's what triggered us doing that initial podcast. Now we're fast forward 3, maybe 4 years, time flies. Yeah. So can you kind of shed some light on what you do on a daily basis, how often you see REBOA, and maybe the evolution of where are we going to see REBOA maybe in five years?
I think it's interesting, one thing you said to begin with, which is that REBOA is mainstream, and I would tell you that among my partners, I'm probably viewed as more innovative and maybe even avant-garde with my use of REBOA. I think if you compare it to the standard which we've used in the past for resuscitation or operative resuscitation, it's been ED thoracotomy, resuscitative thoracotomy, where you're making the slash and burn entry into the chest, opening the pericardium, clamping the aorta, And the whole goal of that, and there's some other things you can do, but the main goal is to try and get a clamp on the aorta to basically maintain a central perfusion pressure so that you're perfusing the heart and the brain while you like get resuscitated fluid in people and then get them to the operating room for a definitive management. I would say that REBOA has become more mainstream, but it's definitely not mainstream, and there's a lot of debate about it across the country. I have some really good friends on the West Coast who are really thought leaders in terms of REBOA, and I think that when they're at meetings, they're really still defending the technology. When I think about REBOA, I think about non-compressible torso hemorrhage, so that bleeding between the clavicles and the groin, where we don't have a good method to control bleeding right now, either from vascular injury or solid organ injury, especially really starting in the pre-hospital sense. I think that when I see those injuries coming in and I hear that they're in a pre-arrest or class 4 hemorrhagic shock status, that's when I start thinking about REBOA. One of the pictures I just showed in our presentation was it's a cartoon depiction of Huckleberry Hound drinking water and it springing out of his torso. And it really wasn't until I saw that's what really kind of encapsulated my thought of non-compressible torso hemorrhage. So even though we're like pouring blood in people 300 cc's at a time, they're still continuing to hemorrhage. And so we've only dealt with like part of the problem. We haven't figured out up until now like a good way to put a cork in the bottom of that bucket to keep the water from running out as we're trying to fill it up. And I think that's really how I view REBOA, is that plug in the bucket that can help abate some of the bleeding, maintain that volume in the intravascular space circulating while we're continuing to pour blood in, pour fluid in until we can get that person to definitive management.
Okay. So, and I think that's amazing. And I think you're correct. When I mean mainstream, I think it's a topic of discussion. You hear it, you see it. When I teach my review classes around the country, I always go over it. A lot of people have never heard it. And so I think they're very fascinated by it. So I think that it's great that we're able to sit down and talk about this and actually have real life application experience. Would you say, correct me if I'm wrong, you have zone 1, zone 2, zone 3. Mm-hmm. Zone 2 is off limits. Zone 1 is above the diaphragm. Zone 3 is going to be below.
Right.
And do you find that you have most commonly zone 3 injuries? And what type of injuries are associated with that?
So for the people that coming in, the zone, as we all know, or may not know, zone 2 is like that area where visceral organs are coming off, like celiac artery, superior mesenteric artery, renals. We want to try and avoid that area. We don't want to include blood flow to the gut or the liver or the renals. For patients that come in extremis or really like DOA, almost DOA, extremis, class 4 hemorrhagic shock, we're usually going to zone 1 for those people initially.
Okay.
The beauty of an endoluminal devices or endovascular devices that we can move that balloon. We have the data to show that we're moving the balloon from zone 1 to zone 3 as necessary. We are using the balloon. We are using REBOA a lot more commonly in zone 3. It's really become a significant part of the way that we treat pelvic fractures, especially the big open book pelvises and the patients with SI joint disruption. That's been the primary area, and I would say that's probably about 50 to 60% of our usage of REBOA currently. Right now, I would say we've had a little bit of a seasonal dip in the number of REBOAs that we've used. Honestly, we've seen a lot more blunt minor traumas in the past couple months. But I would say on average we use REBOA like once or twice a month. I think the big thing is one of the big things I've changed in my practice is moving towards using REBOA for penetrating injuries and not just blunt injuries. One of the cases that I just gave was a young college student who was shot. I suspect it had an iliac artery injury. but was hypotensive, and I just didn't think they would make the trip from our resuscitation bay to the OR. Inserted a Reboah catheter, put it in zone 3 because I suspected they had the iliac injury. Was able to get their blood pressure from I think like 60 up to 100. Got 4 units of blood in them, made the trip to the OR. A lot of the bleeding was controlled by having that balloon in the distal aorta. So I think, like, from my standpoint, that's one of the big areas I think that I'm moving towards, is using it instead of just in blunt trauma, starting to use it more in penetrating trauma.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, and if you think about the stories and you think about past cases like that, I mean, that's you're saving lives by doing that. I mean, those decisions are huge. So pelvic fracture, you said, most common open book, vertical shear.
Yeah.
Pep injuries, and then spleen, liver as
yep.
well.
Yeah.
Okay. And then how long, let's talk about like how long you're keeping these occluded, like maximum amount. So zone 3 versus zone 1.
So I don't think the true maximum amount's been clearly elucidated yet. I think the goal would obviously be to use it as long as you need it. My experience has been this, that one of the things when we're using this, we stay in pretty direct communication with our anesthesiologist colleagues, you know, at the head of the bed, and we tell them when we're coming up and when we're coming down on the balloon. I'll go back to the case I just gave you. We had the Reboah balloon up in zone 3. We got control of the left iliac artery. We let our anesthesiologist know that we were going to be dropping the balloon, which means that we were going to start perfusing the whole right leg, which means we have, you know, redistribution of flow to, you know, whole extremity, which is, we knew was going to drop our blood pressure. And we said, you know, when we drop this balloon, let us know. You know, you may be under resuscitated, the blood pressure is going to drop. And surely, you know, even though they'd given like probably 10 or 12 units of blood at that point, we dropped the balloon, started perfusing the right leg. Blood pressure dropped. We were able to go back up on the balloon again for another 20 minutes while they gave more blood and more product from the blood bank. So initially we had the balloon up for about 20 to 30 minutes while we were getting, you know, made the trip from the trauma bay to the OR, got into the belly, got vascular control. I said that was probably about, you know, 20, I'd say about 30 minutes, you know, operated with the balloon down for a while. While anesthesia was catching up, and then we said we're going to release this and then let them know we were back up on the balloon for another 20 minutes. So you can go up and down, you can let the balloon up and down. One of the keys is to let the balloon down slowly so you don't create a circulatory collapse. But I would say the max I've had a balloon on and off is for about an hour and a half. Now, I wouldn't say I would leave the balloon up for an hour and a half straight, but we do, you know, it is sort of a little bit of a moving target, and, you know, as, but that's the nice thing, is that, you know, we're not in the chest. We have the balloon right there where we're operating. It's right in your, you know, the access is in your groin, and we can let the balloon up and down as needed.
Yeah. So you brought up a lot of points that trigger my curiosity. I think inflating and deflating the balloon. Are you doing that for? Is there any risk for reperfusion injuries?
Somewhat. And that's why we want to let the balloon. That's why we want to let the balloon down as quickly as possible. I think that there is a real risk if you were to have it up for an hour of a reperfusion injury. But again, that's why, you know, we let it down as soon as we find out we don't need it. And if we have to, like anesthesia says, look, we're dropping our pressure, we're going to get more blood, we can go back up on it. But I think I agree that there is probably a real risk of perfusion injury if you left it on. The question is, like, how long is that? I don't think anybody really knows yet.
Yeah. Well, and I think the other thing that really...
Having said that, I think across the country, I mean, there have been some limbs lost due to this, but I don't think they're reperfusion injury. I think they're more insertion technical problems.
Okay. I think what you said that also hit home is that when you do reinflate that balloon, the volume enters the legs and or that one leg, and, you know, we know that there's up to 20% of your blood volume goes in your legs. So that's something I hadn't really even considered, that that's definitely something you have to account for, and you have to have that team approach and communication. Yeah. How much volume are you putting in that balloon?
So it's funny you say that, or funny you ask. That was one of the first things we learned about Reboah catheters. When one of my good friends, Megan Brenner, who was at Shock Trauma, first taught us how to use the balloon. Three of us went. It was Jonathan Wynn, myself, and Aviva Bashan. She taught us like catheter use when she was a shock. They were teaching the ER Reboa, which is a PryTime device. It holds about 24 cc's of fluid or air in it. And so we were inflating the balloon all the way every time. And in the first four or five cases, we had three balloon ruptures. And so we went back to, you know, we got back in touch with Megan, and then touched base with PryTime. And what we learned was that in the interim, you know, across the country, people were having balloon ruptures. Obviously, the balloon's designed to rupture before the aorta ruptures. But what I think the teaching paradigm had changed such that they were teaching, you know, you only need about 5 cc's in the distal aorta, so zone 3, you only need about 5 cc's for most people, 5 to 8 cc's. And then in the proximal aorta, so zone 1, you only need about like 8 to 10 or 12 cc's. So we've like really drastically reduced the amount of, you know, contrast and fluid that we're putting into the balloons now.
Wow. I think that's really cool. You know, not having been able to watch something like that, I think that that brings, you know, a picture. Picture says everything. When you look at the, can you talk about like the cannulation? So, common femoral, is that correct? Is that cut down based on, are they already in arrest, or do you do this by ultrasound?
Yeah. So one of the nice things about the ER Reboa device over the original version of this, which was the coated balloon, is that obviously we can use the ER Reboa, which is a percutaneous insertion. We do strongly emphasize ultrasound identification of the common femoral artery, because when you're trying to access, if you access the superficial femoral artery, which is, you know, just distal to that, there's a higher risk of injury to the artery. We get in this, the common femoral artery, it's the risk goes down, and it's actually easier to cannulate. And about 40% of the cases, I'm sorry, about 70% of the cases, we've been able to use percutaneous access. We've had about, out of 20 cases, we've had like 5 cut downs. All of those were essentially patients that were either we're basically pulseless, and there was no activity on the ultrasound to be able to distinguish the artery from the vein. And in that circumstance, you know, we would try percutaneous, but we couldn't, you know, you couldn't really reliably distinguish between the artery and the vein, because the blood's basically the same color. There's no pressure differential. And to ensure that we got good access, I've cut down on the artery. So.
Are you using this if somebody comes in and just standard cardiac arrest? Is there a application for that?
I think that probably depends on the surgeon. When people come in cardiac arrest, if they have no signs of life, and what I mean by that is they have this is how I define life in trauma patients. You either have to have cardiac activity or a narrow rhythm on your rhythm strip. And I think if you have that narrow rhythm as opposed to that wide complex bradycardia, sure, that we see, the narrow rhythm indicates that the heart has been perfused within the last 5 to 10 minutes. I think it's always difficult when we, you know, when you base it just on time until, you know, when somebody actually died or not. So if they have cardiac activity, and they have a narrow pulse rhythm, then in my mind, that's somebody that I'm going to go ahead and proceed with life-saving procedures, because it's not going to be, you know, it's not going to be futile. And yes, we, you know, will proceed with the Reboa. Here's my thoughts on this. If you have injuries to the chest, then you need to be in the chest, and you need to be doing a resuscitative thoracotomy for those patients that come in with signs of life. If you don't have injuries to the chest, or like say penetrating injuries to the chest, or, you know, any chest X-ray evidence of something, or decreased breast sounds or chest tube output that indicates that there's active hemorrhage in the chest, then I don't open the chest, because that's a huge source of, that's another source of blood loss, and it's another source of volume, you know, insensible volume loss for patients that honestly can't really tolerate even like small changes in their volume, you know, as we're trying to resuscitate them. So in those patients, I will proceed with Reboa, or the patients that don't have thoracic injury that come in extremis, you know, near rest. Those are people I use Reboa in, whether it's penetrating or blunt.
That's really cool. So have you seen an increase or decrease? Obviously, you're seeing benefit. Patients that have come in arrest or near arrest or at that borderline that otherwise you're pretty confident wouldn't have been able to be resuscitated without Reboa.
I think when I compare myself to some of my partners, I see some of my partners still utilizing ED thoracotomy. I think that's kind of what they feel most comfortable with. I feel just as comfortable putting in Reboa to save somebody's life as I would. I think our number of our ED thoracotomies has gone down as we've seen like a gradual increase in our experience with Reboa. But there are still people who really rely heavily on their training, which is with ED thoracotomy.
So. Right.
But I think there is a group of us at Grady that are really kind of, I don't want to say pushing the envelope because I think this technology is here to stay, but feel, you know, have the training and, you know, really feel like Reboa is our go-to for these types of situations.
Sure. So let's get on to the topic that everybody is always asking is, where do you see this progressing? Do you see this progressing into the pre-hospital environment? You know, I think my thought process on the HIMS side is I see it as a HIMS thing. With that being said, I think starting out where I envision this is probably hospital-based systems that are attached to a trauma center, that come back to that trauma center. They have continuous training on that stuff. They have the support of a Reboa team and a surgeon that's up on Reboa, obviously. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just kind of my thought process. And could you kind of weigh in on that?
I think, so obviously there's case reports, and I think you alluded to it a minute ago, especially in Europe, where there are pre-hospital teams that are using Reboa for non-compressible torso hemorrhage to get people to the operating room. There are obviously case reports where that's been successful. I would like to think that ultimately that's where this is going to go in a civilian, from a civilian standpoint. I can tell you that, you know, we have a lot of exposure to some like medics from both Ranger and Spec Op programs that I know are being trained to use Reboa device for military use. I don't know that we've breached that from a civilian standpoint yet. I think the foreseeable future for Reboa is going to be in a rural application, in a transport application where providers at smaller hospitals are stabilizing people with either traumas, either from a traumatic standpoint. I think there's going to be indications from like other surgical standpoints, like placental abruption, GI bleeds, where ER physicians are going to be employing these devices and transporting people to a higher level of care. I think that's probably going to be the next step. And I know that across the country, in Reboa training programs, we're starting to focus on not only trauma surgeons, but also ER physicians, you know, obstetricians, general surgeons, and that sort of thing. I think that one of the things that I've essentially convinced myself of is that the real application is pre-hospital, whether you define it in the field or at a rural or smaller hospital, transported to a higher level of care. I think we have a special circumstance at Grady due to the logistics, due to some logistical issues where it is a good setup for us to use to be able to transport people from our trauma bay to our OR, from our helipad to our OR, but I don't know that that's applicable at every level one trauma center.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I hadn't really thought of it, and I think that would definitely be, that's interesting to think of it that way.
Yeah, and so this is what I tell people that are not really, that are resistant to the technology and learning the technology is that, you know, at your trauma center, you may not want to use Reboa, but you should at least familiarize yourself with the concept and the applications of it and the insertion and removal of it, because probably within the next couple of years, you're going to have robotic devices start showing up in your hospital, people being transported in, either by an EMS helicopter, however your system is set up to receive, critically injured and critically ill patients. I know that there's also case reports that are starting to be used in medical arrests, or like heart attacks, sepsis and that sort of thing as well. So
sure. Yeah. What do you think what's the reluctance? Why is there naysayers? What's the big thing? I don't want to put you on the spot, but what do you think is the biggest thing that you see as far as...
I like being on the spot. I think that in general, as technology, as people have trained and they get further away from their training, certain technologies aren't as familiar. And so, when I finished general surgery residency in 2005, endovascular was, I'd say, moderately new to vascular surgeons. And so for a general surgeon, it's probably not a skill set that you have, or it's not a skill set that you think that you have. And so thinking about trying to go back and learn an endovascular skill set, maybe more of a challenge than you want to take on. But for me, and having put in, a number of these devices, it's very analogous to putting in an arterial line, or putting in a central line, really. It's, we teach people not to put central lines in the artery, but now we're telling you to put a central line in the artery. So I think it's part of learning a new skill, which I think, again, as you get further away from your base training, yeah, you may be a little bit more reluctant to do that. I think that some people are still waiting on the data to show a utility in it. I think that some people compare it to ED thoracotomy, and in some ways see it as inferior to thoracotomy, because you're not opening up the pericardium, you're not cross clamping the hilum of the lung. But if you think about it, the only time you need to really do those things is if you have a cardiac injury, or if you have a lung injury. We can give epinephrine through central lines and stuff like that that are almost adjacent to the heart, so you're still getting you still can get circulatory levels of epinephrine without having to give it directly into the cardiac muscle. So I think people are still waiting. I think some people are still waiting to see kind of what the data is going to show on this. And
sure,
Yeah, that's why I appreciate you. I really appreciate the opportunity to come out and talk at the conference. But I really also appreciate the talk on your podcast, is to try and get this message out that it's not just it's not, in some ways it's not an ED thoracotomy, and the fact that we were comparing it to ED thoracotomy may be a little bit of a stretch, although they're kind of used in the same vein. I would really stress the resuscitative nature of it, which is the first, which is first word in REBOA, is that I think of, you got to plug the hole in the bucket as you're filling it up, or you're never gonna fill it up.
Sure.
So.
Well, and just common sense, it seems like, the evasiveness of, doing a thoracotomy, a full thoracotomy versus, an art line cannulation of the femoral artery.
Yeah.
Big difference.
That's a lot of difference.
Big difference. And think about if you survive that. So, and then, are you, what type of thoracotomy are you doing? Are you doing the clamshell, or are you doing
Right.
I mean, you're basically flopping the whole chest up.
Right. And that's the picture I just showed, was, we had did a clamshell thoracotomy, on a patient that probably would have benefited from a REBOA. Based on the injury that we found, unfortunately the guy had arrested, but I mean, that thoracotomy incision is its own source of morbidity for survivors. And so I agree 100% with what you're saying, and it's not a it had been the price of admission, it's an expensive ticket.
Well, that's awesome. I do have I don't know if there's anything else on REBOA that you kind of want to cover. I think I love that we're getting the message out, and I've learned some new stuff and some I can take back to all my courses. I do have some questions on blood products.
Sure.
And the whole aspect of, you know, we've seen a big paradigm shift. You know, I know there's been multiple studies, the proper trial, you know, different studies, and you know, more and more aircraft out there are carrying blood, packed red blood cells. Some of them are carrying FFP as well. When you look at that, the aspect of the citrate, and you start dealing with the whole massive transfusion, you know, over 6 units of blood products, is that how you classify?
I think that's the modern definition. When I was started as a fellow doing research, we used 10, but I think 6 is kind of the modern definition.
So how do you deal with that? How do you deal with the secondary?
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Wes, what do y'all carry on y'all's helicopter? Y'all have transdynamic acid now?
We carry TXA, and essentially, you know, if a patient's going to, if they're going to need TXA, they're going to need blood. If they're going to need blood, they're going to need TXA. So we will give them a gram over 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And then we will initiate the second gram infusion.
Mm-hmm.
And then we carry 2 units of PRBCs, 1 O neg, 1 O positive, and 2 units of liquid plasma. Yeah.
So I was wondering, because I think transaminic acid is also one of those things that's sort of, I think most people have kind of caught on to it by now, but it's one of the things we kind of encourage.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, you didn't interrupt. Yeah. No, I think that's great. I guess, you know, I read about all the stuff with the citrate, you know, the whole calcium, magnesium aspect, you know, the 2,3-DPG, you know, binding with all the 2,3-DPG. And I guess my question is, at what point, you know, these patients are severely acidotic because of massive hemorrhage. I mean, if you look at one of my favorite topics is the hemoglobin curve and that relationship, and you look at that relationship, and they're going to be in a right shift, but then you have all this blood that is binding with the 2,3-DPG, and so are you able to offload that oxygen? So is there anything that you worry about? Is that something you just have to just know that you have to deal with in...
Yeah.
You know, how do you deal with that? And then the new studies out that they know in just a few hours of citrate being added to that blood product, you have a destruction of cortisol and vasopressin. And
yeah.
So
that's a you know, I think that's a really tough question, and it really kind of speaks to where we are in terms of like resuscitation in general. You know, based on the military data that's come out of Iraq, you know, Operation Iraqi Freedom and, you know, Afghan conflicts, that one of the, you know, this concept of damage control resuscitation, along with the backbone being massive transfusion protocol with component therapy, you know, is how we've done it in the civilian center. You know, honestly, from a trauma standpoint, I think the main thing is to try and get blood into people as quickly as possible. I don't know that component therapy is the best way to do that. And I'll be honest with you, at Grady, we are actually moving, and this is kind of like hot off the press type stuff, I think we're actually moving towards utilizing whole blood from our blood bank. And I think that's really going to hopefully may not fully mitigate all these changes, but you know, all the biochemical and physiologic changes of blood that you were just mentioning. But I think we're looking to that to offset some of these things and hopefully, you know, mitigate some of these acidosis that's generated by component therapy. And so I think that's what we're, you know, and obviously we're going to study this. One of my partners, Jonathan Wynn, is sort of leading the charge on this with our chief of trauma, Peter Ree. And so I think that that's something we're probably going to have more insight to in the upcoming months.
Well, no, I think that's great when you look at the whole blood aspect. Obviously, the military is able to do that, and they have that walking blood bank, and they're able to do that. I've just always been curious from the trauma surgeon perspective on, you know, is that just something obviously you know happens?
Yeah.
You look at the lesser of two evils, right? It's either death by normal saline or you replace with blood products.
Yeah.
And you have to go with what you have.
I think the main thing, again, is you have to get blood.
Yeah.
You have to get oxygen to the tissues that need it. And the best way we have to do that right now is with blood.
Sure.
We've tried over the past 20 years, you know, hemoglobin analogs, and none of them really panned out in terms of being able to, you know, recreate what you know, what our good Lord and Maker has given us, which is blood. And so while there are some drawbacks to, you know, packed red blood cell and packed red blood cell transfusion, you know, we know that if you're given old blood, that's not as good as new blood. But I still think that blood and FFP platelets are probably the best that we have now. And again, it's you know, it's sort of the price of admission, you know, when you're in, when you're critically injured, and we want to but you know, that's just kind of where we are right now. And like I said, I don't even think twice about like the side effects of blood.
Sure.
Because without it, you're, you know,
you're
dead.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. I guess I'm a, you know, I'm a big nerd when it comes to cellular stuff. Yeah. I mean, I like to know something to the extent of being able to explain it. And so, you know, stuff like that fascinates me. And I've just always wanted to ask. Yeah. So that's why I asked. You know, I completely understand your answer. Well, is there anything else you think that we haven't covered? Anything?
I think we covered Reboa pretty well, at least what I know about it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I think that that's all that I had. I would like to say that, you know, we're starting to do some education at Grady surrounding Reboa. We've got we offer a great, it is a great course, but the title of it's great. It stands for Grady Resuscitative Endovascular Approaches for Trauma, where we focus on Reboa. We focus on some other new and upcoming innovative technologies like different types of foams, different types of chest tube products and stuff like that. So I think, you know, as we move forward with that, you want to open that up to the EMS and trauma community in Georgia. So,
well, speaking of foams, you pulled that up. I just had read something about that. I mean, so I guess my curiosity is like, obviously, you foam somebody, you foam, you know, getting that foam out.
let me just say this. We are in, looking at doing some, we are looking at partnering and collaborating with some groups out of the Northeast, looking at, you know, different types of foams. I personally don't have any experience with them. But I think that as we move forward, again, with Grady being the largest trauma center, you know, in Georgia, I think that, you know, we're really looking for these opportunities to collaborate and be innovative, you know, with our industry and other academic partners. So maybe we can have another podcast in the future to talk about rescue foam or something. So.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. I think that'd be great.
So you said a second ago, with trauma patients, you are definitely a proponent of getting blood into them and getting it into them as fast as possible.
Yes.
It seems like it just makes sense, right? What are your thoughts on crystalloid fluid in trauma patients?
I think that concept has started to... let me say this. So we're always trying to strike a balance between... when's enough. Like, we want to get their blood pressure up, but not high enough to where you have this phenomenon of like popping the clot off. And I think we've all seen that. You have somebody who is sort of, you know, borderline, like blood pressure 80s over 90, 80 or 90s. You know, we give them a couple of units of fluid or give them a couple of liters of fluid, give them a couple of units of blood, and they're, you know, next thing you know, they start bleeding from an injury that they didn't have earlier. So this is my take on it. I try to keep their blood pressure like around, you know, 90 to 100 with blood if you have it. If crystalloid, I think that most people have tried to minimize the amount of crystalloid in their resuscitations. The standard that I was trained with, you know, I don't even hate to say this, 20 years ago, like a mandatory 2 liters of crystalloid, I think that's gone by the wayside. I don't think that the American College of Surgeons teaches that. We definitely don't teach our trainees that. You know, where you get to a place where, I try to maintain their blood pressure and their central perfusion pressure, like in that like 80 to 90, you know, alive sort of area without running their blood pressure up too high. So you don't get in a situation where you like pop the clot off. But I definitely have tried to minimize the amount of crystalloid resuscitation that's been demonstrated to have unfavorable outcomes in our patients. So, we've kind of abandoned that concept of a mandatory 1 to 2 liters of crystalloid before they get to the hospital.
Yeah, yeah. Well, good stuff. I mean, I think all this stuff is, you know, is and are, you know, questions that we hear constantly. And I think it's great that we're able to, you know, be able to ask you and yeah. talk to you and meet you and, you know, get your message out. And,
okay. And I think well, I really appreciate it. Like I said, I really appreciate the opportunity to come out and talk about something that, you know, I'm passionate about, which is, you know, Reboa and trauma. And like I said, we've got, you know, good partners with, we've got, you know, good partners with, you know, with our flight crew and EMS in Atlanta and yeah. the surrounding metro area. And so, you know, anything we can do to help with education, I think is, it, you know, it helps us help other people, you know, to help us. And so it's, you know, it's a really big circle and a real big, you know, collaborative effort. So we're always glad to participate.
Well, awesome. Well, I think we're going to wrap up the podcast on behalf of Westfoot. Thank you for bringing us all together and for you know, inviting me here to this conference. It's been amazing. Very nice to meet you, Dr. Morris.
Nice to meet you as well.
Thank you for coming on and you know, taking rapid fire questions. And on behalf of Flightbird Jet and everybody that's you know, involved in Flightbird Jet, you know, we have an amazing team. Hope to see everybody at Fast 18. And we will talk to you soon.
This has been a production of the FlightBridge Ed Podcast, leading the way in pre-hospital critical care and emergency medicine education.